Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yalki in Washington. Ahead, a convicted Israeli spy is to get his freedom. Turkey's decision not to put army forces in the fight against ISIS. How will the internet generation fit into the workforce?
We are looking at this generation as kind of the reality check generation.
And a new song from the boxing film Southpaw, coming up on The Voice of America. A federal parole board has ruled that former U.S. Navy civilian intelligence analyst Jonathan Pollard, convicted in 1987 of spying for Israel, will be freed November 21st after nearly 30 years in prison. My colleague Victor Beatty is following this story and joins us now here in the studio. Victor.
Hello, Susan. Well, the planned release was immediately welcomed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who indicated he repeatedly raised the subject with successive U.S. administrations. Secretary of State John Kerry Tuesday told reporters there is no link between the announcement and efforts to ease Israeli concerns about the just-concluded international nuclear agreement with Iran. Israel has indicated it will not dilute its opposition to the Iran deal. Regional analyst Michael Fishback of Virginia's Randolph-Macon College has followed the Pollard case since he was arrested in 1985 and told me the decision by the U.S. Parole Commission is huge and a milestone in U.S.-Israeli relations.
The Pollard issue has been a thorn in the side for both parties for three decades. And the fact that Pollard is going to be released at all, let alone at this time, is simply a breathtaking announcement. And Secretary of State John Kerry can say all he wants that it has nothing to do with the Iran deal. Frankly, nobody's going to believe that, even if it's true. Nobody's going to believe it. There has just been so much effort on the part of administrative officials in several American administrations in recent decades to prevent the release of Pollard under any circumstances that to have it come particularly now is simply too coincidental for anybody to believe. On its own, it's a big thing, and especially at this time period, it's a very big thing.
Did what he do, what he was convicted of, a serious offense?
Well, it was, and I'm not defending or not defending what he did, but past secretaries of defense, I remember Caspar Weinberger, vehemently insisted that Pollard should never see the light of day again, that what he had done was one of the worst cases of espionage in American history. Now, many of Pollard's defenders say, well, Israel is an ally, it was spying for an ally. The fact is that whether one is a defender or a protagonist against Pollard, it wasn't simply information about the United States that he revealed. What he revealed to the Israelis, among other things, were very detailed information about what was then the Soviet Union, its missile capacities, where its missiles were located. And it is believed by many that Israel's own strategic nuclear arsenal was configured in such a way to deal with that. So intelligence gathering techniques, specific information about the Soviet Union, it went way beyond simply passing on, as his defender said, information about Arab states. It was a major security breach, and especially because it was an ally, and especially because the Israelis never publicly apologized for it, it turned into a real thorn in the side for the United States.
According to the Associated Press, the U.S. previously dangled the prospect of his release, including during Israeli-Palestinian talks last year when the Obama administration considered the possibility of freeing Pollard as part of a package of incentives to keep Israel at the negotiating table. So this is not the first time this has been considered.
No, not at all, and quite often it is brought up by the other side. There have been times when the Israelis and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu himself personally have brought up release of Pollard as a sweetener. That is to say, if the Israelis stayed in negotiations with the Palestinians, if they conceded certain things, then would the Americans release Pollard? Now, that always struck some people as odd, that if Israel was negotiating with the Palestinians for its own sake, for its own future, why would the United States need to provide a sweetener to the deal by releasing Pollard? So, yes, Jonathan Pollard has been a ping-pong ball in American-Israeli relations for quite some time now.
And the 60-year-old American-born Pollard, who has dual Israeli citizenship, is now serving in a federal prison in Butner, North Carolina. He is said to be in poor health and, under terms of his parole, will be required to stay in the United States for at least 5 years.
Thank you very much, Victor, for that report.
All right, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. Welcome, Andrew. What do you have
to share
today?
Thank you very much. Well, the top story today that we're looking at on social media is Mullah Omar. He's the Taliban chief, and there are rumors that he has been killed in Afghanistan. So social media lighting up about that. It's still very early, so we're seeing kind of the initial stages on social media, people just tweeting out the headlines, tweeting out their, you know, kind of skepticism about the what the headlines are so far. So not a lot of additional information that people are adding. People coming to some theories, though, saying that if it isn't true, it may be just a way to derail the peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, that this rumor might derail some of that. So early, still yet on social media, but surely more to come as that develops, as we get more information.
And they've been searching for him for a long, long time, and they've had rumors like this before.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the interesting thing. When these rumors come out now on social media, they spread like wildfire, right, and people can jump in with their own theories. So it's kind of changing the scope of things for sure. Another trending topic today, Windows 10. Microsoft rolling out the newest iteration of its Windows platform with features such as Cortana, which is kind of their answer to Apple's Siri. Also Edge, which is their new browser, doing away with Internet Explorer and all the problems that caused for a lot of people. Not a lot of fans of Internet Explorer in the tech world. So people tweeting about that, tweeting out some of the bugs that are going on as they install it. One person I thought was very funny, they said, "I'm lighting a candle for all the people installing today. Godspeed," because it's taking several hours to go through the whole process.
My husband's doing that today, and yeah, he's been at it for a while.
Yeah,
I called him, and then he said, "I'm installing Windows 10," and then a while later I called him and said, "I'm still installing Windows 10.
Yeah, it might take him a little while, but Microsoft saying this is a new era for them, so a lot of people, again, skepticism on social media saying, well, we'll wait and see. Once it finally is done installing, we'll actually test it out and let you know. And finally, Nuno Silva, he's a Real Madrid soccer star, and he's in a bit of hot water. Again, we live in the social media age where everybody has a camera in their pocket on their cell phone. Somebody took a picture of him. He was wearing a T-shirt with former Spanish dictator Francisco Franco on it. A lot of people unhappy about that, saying he should be fined. Again, the jokes are coming already. One person saying, oh, he probably thought to himself, should I wear my Guns N' Roses T-shirt this morning or my Franco T-shirt? Let me go with the Franco T-shirt. So jokes about that, certainly partisan based on fandom between Madrid and Barcelona and some other teams. But we'll see if he gets fined on that and maybe he gets his social media locked down.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
If you've ever tried to lose weight, you know how hard it can be, and harder yet to keep off. A new study confirms that. British researchers tracked the weight of nearly 280,000 people over a 10-year period and found the chances of an obese person attaining a normal body weight are very low. According to the study, of those considered obese, with a body mass index of 30 to 35, only 1 in 210 men and 1 in 124 women were able to drop enough weight to be considered normal weight. To make matters worse, the research also finds that about half of those studied that did lose weight gained it back within 2 years. More than three-quarters of them had regained the weight within 5 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Turkey has now become directly involved in the war against the Islamic State, using its air force to strike targets in Syria. Turkey will also work with the U.S. and other nations to create a safe zone in Syria where people will not be subjected to the terror of the Islamic State. Joining me is my colleague Jeffrey Young, who often stops by. Welcome again, Jeffrey. Always nice to have you.
Thank you, Susan. While Turkey's air force is in action, its army is not moving into Syria to engage the Islamic State. Sinan Ogun, the chairman of İDAM, the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies in Istanbul, explains why Ankara is holding back.
Little discussion of that, given that there is no willingness on the side of Turkey or no demonstrated willingness at this point to engage directly Turkish troops. The reason is that this would bring about a number of considerable problems for Turkey, not only from the standpoint of national security, but also from the standpoint of international law, Turkey's relations with countries like Russia and Iran, and so on. So there has, for the time being, the plan, now that Turkey is fully involved in this fight, is to support the efforts of the coalition by opening up the İncirlik Air Base and two more air bases in the southeast of Turkey, but also involving the Turkish Air Force. There are strikes that have been undertaken against the Islamic State targets. But that's really the extent of the direct engagement of the Turkish army. The plan that seems to be agreed between Ankara and Washington calls for members of the Syrian opposition to strengthen and to consolidate this zone free of Islamic State elements.
While the fighting in Syria goes on, Turkey continues to provide shelter for a massive number of refugees from that conflict. Sinan Ogun describes the massive strain this is putting on Turkey.
The official figures indicate that there are about 1.8 million Syrian refugees in the country. About 280,000 of them are in camps that are set up for that purpose in the southeast of the country. But the rest are across Turkey, Istanbul being one of the hubs where apparently there are about 300,000 Syrian refugees. So this is indeed a huge issue for the Turkish government, given that there has been very little burden sharing on, you know, when we look at Turkey's neighborhood. Turkey, it's not only in terms of financial cost, but also there are a number of services that need to be supplied to these people. So health services, education services, and so on. And eventually, given that the Syria situation, the conflict in Syria, is not to be solved anytime soon, this is likely to be a long-term challenge for Turkish policymakers.
That was Sinan Ogun, chairman of İDAM, the Center for Economics and Foreign Policy Studies in Istanbul.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for that report.
Thank you, Susan.
Coming up on International Edition, the maturing of the Internet generation, and a listen to a bit of Kings Never Die. The first U.S. Internet generation is preparing to enter the workforce, but what will they be like? A new study co-conducted by Robert Half explores this question. The district president, Billy Watkins, joins us on the line from New York. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Well, what do you expect from these young people?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You know, we are looking at this generation as kind of the reality check generation. And, you know, some of our findings were interesting in that they tend to have a more traditional approach than maybe, you know, an outlook in terms of their, you know, launching their career and what they expect as they do that than maybe, you know, their generation before them, Generation Y. I think something that was very surprising was that a good number of them, 77%, indicated that they plan to work harder than their predecessors in order to have a successful career. Wasn't that that was a negative. It, you know, some of the results indicate there's a lot of drive in this generation and looking forward to it, but they're realists, and they expect to, you know, potentially have to work longer as well, whereas they like to retire in the 60s. Most are anticipating they may have to work until a minimum 70 years old before they have what they need to actually, you know, successfully retire. So I thought it was really interesting, the pragmatic approach that this generation seems to be taking.
What about the influence of social media in their lives? They've been around it forever.
Right. And so if you think about it, this generation has only known an Internet-based kind of environment. Many probably don't remember life without a smartphone, unlike myself. And so everything that they're about is about social media, you know, access to technology to navigate their careers and, frankly, just navigate their lives. So I think when you're looking at how to connect with this group of potential employees, you have to be realistic about utilizing social media, social networking to gain kind of some interest in their candidacy and connecting with them in a real way so they see value in what you're offering.
Why do you think they're so pragmatic about the future?
Well, if you think about how their exposure, you know, they have been raised in a pretty turbulent economic environment. So they've seen an economic recession. And honestly, it's probably provided a realistic view of what they should expect. They've seen their grandparents maybe have to go back to work or, you know, pick up part-time jobs to frankly, survive. And their parents may be utilizing savings that they thought they may be able to put away for a while to retire early. And so no bad or good necessarily, but just more of a realistic approach to what I need to do to prepare myself for my future and prepare myself for retirement when I can.
Do you think this is going to make for a stronger workforce down the line?
You know, I think having a realistic view on what you should offer and can offer, being driven to succeed, but also being positive about it, certainly helps, right? You know, there are a number of generations that will current, as this generation continues to enter the workforce, and you see about 30 million baby boomers, I think, projected to leave the workforce in 2020, there'll be a lot of generational diversity. So it certainly doesn't help hurt to have a pragmatic approach with kind of the newest employees entering the workforce first. But, you know, I think the diversity that we see across the spectrum also allows us to modify our environment so that we're speaking to all and delivering the best services as corporations.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're tuned to VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Smoking cigarettes is a well-known health hazard and mortality risk. Disease such as Ebola can also radically shorten lifespan. But researchers at the University of Cambridge have released a new study about the impact of having multiple chronic conditions. They find that having more than one of the so-called cardiometabolic conditions, stroke, heart attack, or type 2 diabetes, does not bode well for long life. Their startling conclusion, having two of these conditions by age 60 reduced life expectancy by some 12 years in men and 13 years for women. This was a shorter life expectancy than even that of lifelong smokers. The researchers say their findings highlight the importance of heart disease and stroke prevention for diabetes patients. Health professionals say that healthy lifestyle habits can improve heart and overall health. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
Rapper Eminem teams with No Doubt's Gwen Stefani for a new song from the boxing film Southpaw. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Border Crossing's host Larry London about Kings Never Die.
You might be a fan of his from The Slim Shady or other songs that he's put on the radio, but Eminem has got a new one out, and he teams up with Gwen Stefani from No Doubt for Kings Never Die. Larry, this is from the soundtrack for the new 50 Cent produced movie Southpaw, right?
That's right. It's one of those boxing films. I saw the movie, and it ain't no Rocky, that's for sure.
Well, it's Jake Gyllenhaal,
Jake Gyllenhaal is in the film. And by the way, Eminem was up for the same role, but he turned it down. In fact, he was negotiating to play the lead role,
right,
as the boxer whose name is Billy Hope in the film, but
right,
he said no, eventually deciding against it. So, yes, Jake Gyllenhaal, Rachel McAdams, 50 Cent, who's in the film.
And this song is a, it's, you know, it's kind of one of those angry rap anthem, get your blood up. It'd be great to work out to. It'd be a great workout song.
Eminem's got three songs on the soundtrack. And by the way, as a side note, this film was scored by James Horner, who passed away in June.
Right, the guy who did Titanic.
That's right. This is his last film that he put music in, and the end, they say in memory of James Horner.
I can hear the drummer drumming. In the trumpet, someone's trying to summon someone. I know something's coming, but I'm running from it to be standing at the summit and plummet. How come it wasn't what I thought it was? Was it too good to be true? Have nothing, get it all, but too much of it, then lose it again. Did I swallow hallucinogens? Because if not, where the hell did it go? Because here I sit and lose it to sin by the touch of and just choosing to sin, even if it means I'm selling my soul just to be the undisputed again. Do whatever.
This particular song that Eminem and Gwen Stefani perform doesn't appear until you're two-thirds of the way through the film. It's right near the end with the big fight, which I'm not going to reveal too much about, but the big fight that comes at the end, and you hear this song playing. And when you hear it in the film, you don't really hear much Gwen Stefani, but when you hear the song itself, she's featured in the song. You can tell it's her.
Now, this is not a big departure for Eminem because he's, you know, kind of in your face. But Gwen Stefani is more kind of mellow type thing. So this is a little, is she branching out with this tune?
Well, I can't necessarily say that, but she has been working on a new solo album. She's slow on the project. She's been working with Pharrell. We don't have a date. We don't have a title. We know very little about it. I know that she's doing some shows with No Doubt. And she's also going to be coaching on The Voice, replacing Christina Aguilera here in the U.S.
Okay, well, that's VOA's Larry London. You can hit him up on Twitter. That's at VOA underscore music. You can also watch his show, which is Border Crossings. That's on our website, www.voanews.com. If you want to send us a tweet, we're at VOA underscore IE. And if you want to send one to me, I'm at David underscore D Bird. When I close my eyes through the passage of time, kings never die. Kings never die.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underline IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist six rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jokriak, and Major General Santino Dengwal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All six had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.